Well, it's delightful to be here, and I have to say that part of the inspiration for the talk today is the fact that just over a year ago, I was sitting in this room with a group of colleagues, Marcus Gehring amongst them, discussing international law in the era of climate change. And so my remarks this lunchtime are drawn from a chapter which I've done for a book that Rosemary Rafis and Shirley Scott of the University of New South Wales are preparing for a publisher, not CUPLS, but Edward Elgar, on international law in the era of climate change, and that's just going to press. So as the summary of the lecture indicated on the website, and as I'm about to disclaim now, notwithstanding the fact that the climate change COP in Durban is due to commence in about 10 days' time, a week on Monday, I am not, in the course of this talk, going to give you a current events update on what might or might not be determined at Durban. Rather, my intent is to look outside the traditional climate change regime, principally focusing on international environmental treaties, to ask the question the extent to which these other regimes are concerned with climate change and the synergies between them. So I start, of course, outlining the fact that climate change has been described as the most significant environmental challenge of our time and a truly global issue. And this universalist paradigm of climate change reflects both the nature and reach of the problem and the global scale of the action required to address it. As Ahmed and French observe, it pushes us towards a view of the multilateral climate change regime as the principal, if not the exclusive, normative expression of the political need to act. Well, I dispute that exclusivity. That's in part the point of my remarks today. And for those of you keeping track of the ever-burgeoning literature on climate change and international law, this chapter by Ahmed and French will appear in a Hart publication early in 2012 on exploring the legal and chronological consequences of climate change. Well, a narrow view of this multilateral climate change regime comprises the main climate change instruments, of course, the UNFCCC and the Kyoto Protocol, which are themselves, of course, recognized as important international environmental milestones in the development of international environmental law. In general international environmental texts and the Blue Book, Big Blue Book is no exception in this regard, it's conventionally addressed in chapters addressed to air pollution and ozone depletion as part of a wider discussion of instruments relating to the atmosphere. But of course, we would immediately note here an instrument gap in terms of coverage because, as you're well aware, there is no global instrument on the protection of the atmosphere, although a recent proposal by Shinya Mirazi for the ILC to take up this issue of protection of the atmosphere, a convention analogous to Part 12 of the Law of the Sea Convention on Protection of the Marine Environment, may become part of the ILC's long-term program of work. And I'll come back to that instrument gap a little later on in my remarks. But the main point to make here is that we get a misleading idea of broader climate change activity if we confine our focus to the UNFCCC and Kyoto Protocol, because there is significant activity outside the climate change regime to address both the impacts of climate change itself and also, and I think this distinction is important, the impact of climate change responses on other areas of international law, including international environmental law. And this, of course, is distinct from the explicit recognition in the Kyoto Protocol in Article 2 of the role of other bodies in reducing specific emissions. So we're thinking here of ICAO for aircraft emissions and the IMO for ships emissions. And of course, there are other areas where the intersection and impact of climate change on activities and instruments covered is coming to the fore. And I'll mention two examples. One is the 2009 resolution adopted by the UN Human Rights Council on the impact of human rights and climate change. And the second, of course, is the ongoing activity in the context of the Law of the Sea, looking at the impact of climate change on a variety of factors, of course, low-lying and small island states, the impact on baselines. The Law of the Sea Convention, in common with many other environmental treaties, takes a relatively fixed approach to baselines. Where we get some differentiation is in the context of shifting deltas in Article 7. We'll need a fundamental rethink as where we draw our baselines from changes as sea level does. And of course, there's the major issue of the impact of greenhouse gas emissions on the marine environment and the acidification of the oceans. Impacts on vulnerable marine species, whether it's coral reef bleaching, the impact on sea turtles and marine environment more broadly. Also relevant in the Law of the Sea context is that second limb I identified of the impact of climate change responses on the marine environment. And here I would highlight two, and one I'll come on to discuss, if time permits, in a little more detail. One is, of course, the development of carbon capture and storage. The impetus here, of course, has come principally from the European Union, where the deadline for implementation of the CCS directive passed in the summer of this year. And so far, at least according to the Commission, only one of the 27 member states is compliant with its implementation obligations, and that's Spain, by the way. The UK isn't, and a variety of others haven't even notified the Commission. Of course, where are we going to dispose of CO2? If we have carbon capture ready, coal-fired power stations, we're collecting CO2, where do we put it? We might put it onshore, but then NIMBYism, public concerns about explosions and so on, come to the fore. What about all those lovely disused or about to be disused oil and gas fields offshore? What about CO2 disposal in undersea reservoirs in the North Sea, for example? So that's something the Norwegians are investigating. But of course, this immediately confronts us with the extant marine environmental treaties which prohibit the disposal of wastes at sea. So we saw legislative amendment to the London Convention and Protocol, the global convention on dumping of waste and other material at sea, and also the OSPAR Convention to facilitate precisely this offshore activity in response to climate change. Having your cake and eating it, still having a carbon-dependent economy, but instead of injecting the CO2 into the atmosphere, you're capturing it and storing it, perhaps forever. So those amendments to OSPAR and the London Convention permit, subject to the permitting regimes under those conventions exercised by national states, the offshore disposal of CO2 in underground reservoirs, not disposing of it in containers on the seabed or injecting it into the water column. However, how do we get it to these underground reservoirs? Oops, Article 6 of the London Protocol prohibits the trans-border movement of wastes, so we had a further amendment to Article 6 of the London Convention to permit that trans-border movement. Problem? Only one state, our intrepid Norway, keen to get on with these activities, has actually ratified that amendment. So currently the parties to the London Protocol are looking for modalities such as the provisional application of the amendment to facilitate an activity in which they hope to engage through EU funding and the implementation of the directive. So there is example number one of carbon capture and storage as a climate change response, albeit one within a vibrant carbon-based economy. The second example, which I'll come on to later if I have time, is ocean fertilisation as one geoengineering method for CO2 removal. In this case, it's stimulating biological productivity in the oceans and ensuring that there's a greater absorption of CO2, the plankton sink, and that's supposed to trap extra CO2 and take CO2 and reduce acidification of the water column. Well, all of these, of course, activities in the marine environment raise the issue of whether they're permitted or prohibited under the lex specialis of the dumping regimes, which I just referred to, and, of course, whether they're compatible with the broader obligations of the 1982 Law of the Sea Convention. Remember, Article 192 has the general obligation to protect and preserve the marine environment, also reflected in customary law. And Article 194, this is again in Part 12 on protection of the marine environment, imposes the obligation to prevent, reduce, and control marine pollution from any source. and that includes in the further provisions from ships, of course, and also land-based sources. So arguably, that general obligation extends to the emission of greenhouse gases from land or from ocean-based activities. But of course, the problem is that doesn't tell us, that doesn't concretize what level of emissions would fall foul of this general obligation. Part of that is defining what constitutes marine pollution. Part of that is asking the question whether you can wire into those general obligations of the Law of the Sea Convention the Kyoto Protocol specific reduction emissions, which Annex I parties have. But again, as you're well aware, there's a further problem there. One is, of course, that we don't have a common standard, but it varies according to each state and the emission limitations that are being imposed upon them. The second crucial limitation is that the major emitter of greenhouse gases, China, doesn't currently have a binding obligation, a binding target. It's not an Annex I state. And secondly, a major emitter, the United States, is not a party at all. So even if we try to concretize, give weight to the Article 192 and 194 obligations, there's a problem of benchmarking what amounts to impermissible harm to the marine environment in that context. And of course, even more complex as we go beyond Copenhagen and Cancun and Durban is the nationally agreed mitigation actions of developing countries and the voluntary nature of the post-2012 Annex I emissions, where developed states offer up national targets, but with a high degree of contingency. How do we interpret the Canadian obligations, which are subject to legislation, not in Canada, but in the United States? That's either seen as very supine. Oh dear, this is being recorded, isn't it? This is a Canadian accent. Right. But having said that, to make the point that we're concerned with activities outside the climate change traditional regime, and we're concerned with reactions and activities to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and their impacts on the one hand, and responding to the possibly deleterious steps taken for climate change mitigation and adaptation, but on general environmental protection. Well, Dan Badansky has characterized the relationship of work within and outside the UNFCCC as comprising four possible categories. The first is simply delegation, that the climate regime delegates certain issues to be addressed elsewhere. And ICAO and IMO are a good example of that specific delegation. We won't deal with it, there are bodies out there competent to do so. The second is what we might call supplementarity, that the issue is not addressed in the climate change regime, which leaves it open to other instruments, if they're competent to do so, and it's within their object and purpose, to address. And one example here is black carbon, which is not one of the six greenhouse gases covered by the climate change regime. So that's being picked up by the regional LRTAP convention in the amendments to the Gothenburg Protocol. Well, of course, that's all very well. That's an Economic Commission for Europe instrument. So immediately we've gone from having a global-based multilateral regime, albeit with some key outliers like US not party to Kyoto, to a regional regime that isn't going to impact on black carbon outside of that regional framework. The third possibility is complementarity. So the matter is addressed or potentially addressable within the UNFCCC framework, but it may also be addressed elsewhere. So you have a twin track. And the fourth is competition, whether we see this as healthy or unhealthy, with other bodies seeking to displace the UNFCCC to move activities outside. And of course, the Montreal Protocol is often referred to as the most successful of our climate change instruments. They're not negotiated explicitly as such. And FSC's regulation of the Montreal Protocol could, of course, displace the UNFCCC. Well, think of these, the relationship of supplementarity and complementarity most accurately reflects the linkages between the climate change regime and multilateral environmental agreements. And hopefully, the ensuing examples I use will serve to underscore that. These categories of relationship between the climate change regime and others, and these activities, raises, of course, the further general question, and again I refer to Ahmed in French, as to whether climate change should be considered, studied, and analysed in glorious abstraction, perhaps in specific courses on international EU climate change and law policy, or even courses now on emissions trading, or whether it should be viewed within a broader, though inevitably untidier, international legal frame. Well, I think there are elements of both, but what I'll be expounding today is perhaps more along the lines of the untidier international legal frame. Well, these elements of supplementarity and complementarity of international environmental legal instruments to the climate change regime are the consequence of at least four factors. The first is the direct and the multiplier effect of climate change on existing challenges for species and habitat. So a number of treaty bodies now address climate change as part of their routine business. It's yet another threat to the species and habitat that instrument was designed to address. The second is the impact, both positive and negative, of climate change responses on species and habitat. A positive example would be the impact reducing emissions from deforestation and forest degradation. So enhances forest biodiversity and enhances carbon sinks at the same time. A negative example would be the impact of ocean iron fertilization on marine biological diversity. The third element driving the synergies, complementarities and synergies is the increasing innovative use of environmental treaty mechanisms by state and non-state actors to address climate change impacts. And I'm thinking here specifically of NGO petitions to the World Heritage Committee to list four properties as in danger of losing their outstanding universal value, the main danger to these properties, like the Great Barrier Reef, being the impact of climate change. And I'll come back to the World Heritage Convention in a moment. And the fourth element is the recognition that other treaty regimes may in fact contribute to combating global warming through their concrete impacts. The example I raised a moment ago about preserving forest biodiversity and, of course, preserving carbon sinks at the same time. There's also complementarity of legal approaches. It's perhaps less relevant now post Cancun and Copenhagen, but one could have contrasted the strongly top-down approach of the climate change framework with the deliberately more bottom-up approach of the 1994 Convention to Combat Desertification. As I say, that's perhaps less of a strong divergence now. Well, these four factors may clearly work in isolation or in combination. For example, the Bonn Convention on Migratory Species has noted that factors 1 and 2, this direct and multiplier effect of climate change impacts on the threats already posed to migratory species, and the impact of climate change responses may combine, and I quote, "Climate change has the capacity to act synergistically with current anthropogenic threats so that species are not only dealing with the direct impacts of climate change, but also the consequences of climate change impacts on humans and, of course, human responses." Well, I'd like now to look at the linkages then between some of the big environmental treaties, the Big Five, if we can call it that, but I don't think I have time to go through all of the Big Five. Sounds like I'm on safari in Kruger, but there happen to be five of them, so there you go. I'll focus on the World Heritage Convention perhaps. But before I do that, I just wanted to remind us about the flip side, which is to what extent does the climate regime take into account the many, many international environmental instruments that predated the Framework Convention or indeed the Kyoto Protocol? Well, perhaps surprisingly, given we've said this is such an important threat to the environment, amongst other things, there are not that many references to the environment and ecosystems in the UNFCCC and the Kyoto Protocol. A rare instance is Article 1 of the Framework Convention, which defines the adverse effects of climate change as changes in the physical environment or biota resulting from climate change, which have significant deleterious effects on, amongst other things, the resilience and productivity of natural and managed ecosystems. Article 4 calls on the parties to promote and cooperate in the conservation and enhancement of biomass, forests, and oceans, and, of course, to elaborate plans, inter alia, to, perhaps, to protect and rehabilitate areas affected by drought and desertification. And Article 2 of the Kyoto Protocol calls on Annex 1 parties to, of course, take steps to enhance and protect greenhouse gas sinks and reservoirs, taking into account commitments under relevant international environmental agreements. Well, that's it. Why such paucity of reference in these two very important environmental, amongst other instruments? Well, I think the first is what Mary Midley has called the no lifeboat option, that a general commitment to greenhouse gas emissions to achieve stabilization of global temperature increase at 2 degrees C will benefit both non-human and human species alike. Well, there's perhaps an inherent anthropocentrism in even advancing that argument, but nonetheless, there is the sense that if we do it for us, it will help them, the natural environment, as well. But the second is that the UNFCCC was not negotiated in a vacuum, as its preamble clearly attests, but rather in the awareness that, of course, there were a number and are a number of existing agreements for the protection of species and habitat, which will inevitably address climate change impacts within their sphere of competence. Some are mentioned in the preamble, some are not. So let them get on with it, and the Climate Change Convention will focus on what it needs to do best, which is to address mitigation and, of course, now adaptation. So perhaps for this reason, and given their experience of collaboration, it's been left to the outlying instruments like the Biodiversity Convention and the Desertification Convention to forge links both with one another and with the UNFCCC to explore linkages and synergies between them. And there is, of course, clear linkage in terms of their primary focus. And there's been a joint liaison group between what they call the three Rio Conventions, the Climate Change Convention, Desertification, and Biodiversity, to facilitate cooperation between the treaty body secretariats. And since 2012, the Rio Conventions have mounted what they call an ecosystems and climate change pavilion, both physically present at COP-MOPS, but also in a website, to have collaborative outreach activity linking biodiversity, climate change, and sustainable land management to raise awareness of the win-win or the co-benefits between the conventions. And of course, cooperation with other instruments is a standing item under the subsidiary body on scientific, technical, and technological advice under the Climate Change Convention itself, so an inward reflection of that outward linkage. And in particular areas, the UNFCCC has drawn on other treaty bodies for expertise. And I think a good recent example is that Ramsar, the Convention on the Protection of Wetlands for the Importance of Wild Birds, has been assisting the Kyoto Protocol Clean Development Mechanism in calculating the carbon storage capacity of mangrove swamps. So direct synergy there between the expertise under the Ramsar Convention and one of the flexibility mechanisms of the Climate Change Convention. And of course, climate change is perhaps the preeminent cross-cutting theme within a wide range of international environmental instruments. Well, of course, one can see there are undoubtedly advantages to these sorts of synergies and cooperation. So enhance synergies, avoid duplication of effort, and promote resource efficiency. On the other hand, the modalities I've just described scarcely scratch the surface of the substantive work to be done in addressing climate change impacts on species and habitat, focusing as they do on informal mechanisms for cooperation through already overstretched and, of course, under-resourced secretariats. They're not getting more people power or money to engage in these activities. So two related points, I think, are already clear. One is that the single most important contribution that the climate change regime can make to the protection of species and habitat is to achieve a stabilization of global temperature increase to 2 degrees C, or what's looking more likely, rather more than that. A task which is clearly outside the principal object and purpose of multilateral environmental agreements. They're not about reducing greenhouse gas emissions. But my second point, and conversely, is that while most MEAs can only address the effects or impacts of climate change, but not the root cause in terms of the source of greenhouse gas emissions, like the burning of fossil fuels, some MEAs do have a potentially significant contribution to make in terms particularly of promoting and enhancing greenhouse gas reservoirs and sinks. The Ramsar mangrove swamps example I just gave, and of course the Convention on Desertification in reducing desertification. Well, the next part of my paper then moves to look at some of the MEAs, and I had prefaced this with some citation of various reports on the adverse effects of climate change on species and habitat, but I think for this audience I scarcely need rehearse it, and it's all rather depressing. But there are perhaps a few points that I might just elaborate upon. One is, of course, that we have a continuum from autonomous adaptation to assisted adaptation to what I call emergency adaptation. So some species and habitat may be able naturally, because it has ecosystem resilience or whatever, to respond to the negative impacts of climate change. Others may need to be assisted in some way through direct management, for example. Others are going to find that without emergency and prompt attention, their ability, not being autonomous, not being assisted, but they need that emergency quick reaction response, otherwise a species may be rendered extinct, for example. And we might see here the three interlinking difficulties here, what we could call the altitudinal, the latitudinal, and, I don't know, a kind of speed problem. The altitudinal is, if you go walking in Scotland, you'll find that on some high Scottish hills, there's a sort of alpine ecosystem. Well, of course, ptarmigan are increasingly found higher and higher up because their alpine ecosystem is disappearing. It comes a point where altitudinally they can't go any higher. So what do they do? The second point is latitudinal, and this is, of course, the plight of the polar bear and the disappearance of ice-covered areas in the Arctic, perhaps as early as 2020. I should say anecdotally, and this is being recorded, I grew up in Winnipeg, which has become the polar bear capital of Canada, and they are investing millions of Canadian dollars, that's not quite as much as millions of UNOMIDAS these days, more than US dollars, anyway, on a polar bear research facility and exhibition in Winnipeg, in the expectation that ex situ conservation of the polar bear may be its only future by the middle of this century. So there you go. Little anecdote there. Not a very happy one either. It's going to be like an aquarium. You can go and watch the polar bear swimming overhead. So if you plan to go to Churchill, it's really expensive. You can wait and go and see them in a zoo, but it's not quite the same, is it? Anyway, the last point was the slow moving, that some species cannot autonomously adapt because they just don't move that quickly. And the classic example here is the Canadian white spruce. It can only move because of the way that it disperses and regenerates at so many miles or kilometres, I should say, per year. And it can't adapt quickly enough for the way in which the climate is advancing and warming. So there are some species that will have difficulty in autonomous adaptation. Well, how do we respond to all of that? Well, first and foremost is the integration of climate change concerns into what I call the day-to-day business or routine business of the major multilateral environmental agreements. This depends, of course, on the object and purpose of the treaty, of its dynamic evolution, perhaps, and obviously on the views of the parties as to how far it can be extended. And of the big five, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, perhaps at the continuum end of we're not too sure what climate change has to do with regulating trade in endangered species. So unlike the other four biodiversity-related treaties, which are not limited to a single threat to the species, in this case trade, there is perhaps more willingness to address it. So although there has been a strategy adopted last year by CITES to climate change and its impacts, there's a view, certainly by some parties, that this is not for CITES to be addressing, even at the strategic level. I think clearly for our other biodiversity-oriented conventions, there's no doubt but that climate change is seen as a central threat and a central plank of their activities. And these other four are, of course, the Ramsar Convention on Wetlands, the World Heritage Convention, the Biodiversity Convention, and the Migratory Species Convention. And I've identified seven categories of response. This maybe isn't exhaustive, but these are the sorts of things in which these treaties have been engaged in their regional business in addressing climate change impacts and threats. The first and most obviously is the need for monitoring and reporting of the impacts of climate change on species and habitat, particularly for vulnerable populations. The second is to build species and ecosystem resilience and the ability to adapt. And this may mean putting even renewed energy into the traditional threats to species and habitat, quite apart from climate change itself. The third is developing response mechanisms to identify climate change impacts, including integration into management plans for protected areas. The fourth is the increased cooperation between treaty bodies that I mentioned, but also piggybacking on cooperation we're seeing increasingly in private-public partnerships between the conventions on the one hand, like Ramsar, and private companies like Danone or Coca-Cola on the other. The fifth is increased collaborative outreach activities to integrate responses, and the ecosystem pavilion response I mentioned earlier is one such example. The sixth is the emergency adaptation response I referred to earlier, the endangered species rescue and relocation. Under all of these biodiversity-related conventions, there are extremities issues in that certain species, like polar bears and habitat, like the alpine, have nowhere else to go or can't, as I said, adapt quickly enough. So an emergency response may be necessary. And as I'll note in a moment, we have two rather good examples of this, albeit in rather tragic circumstances. One was Operation Noah's Ark, where after the end of the Angolan Civil War, where there'd been extensive poaching as well as unfortunate collateral damage to wildlife, there were virtually no animals left in the game parks in Angola. So Operation Noah's Ark was to take pairs of the big five, amongst others, from South Africa and to repopulate the parks in Angola. So that's a kind of site banking, but across borders. The second example is the Great Apes Rescue Plan, which was put in place for the Congo, amongst others, again a reflection of armed conflict impacting on the habitat. Well, you can imagine those emergency responses, which for the environmental treaties concerned are extra budget, so you're able to say, here's this, you know, charismatic megafauna that's endangered, we need some money to do emergency response, find an appropriate place for site banking, off you go. It's not precisely ex situ conservation, but it's along those lines. Now, I think that works fine if it is charismatic megafauna, but are we going to do it for ants and beetles and parasites and things like that? Of course, no, we're not. So it's a response which is unlikely to address the full range of impacts. The seventh and final response that we see within the biodiversity-related conventions is the increased use by NGOs of mechanisms, both formal and informal, to challenge climate change action or inaction. And I've mentioned already the petitions to the World Heritage Convention. We see it also piggybacking in domestic litigation. Recently, for example, you had judicial review sought through the US federal court of the US implementation of polar bears listing under the Endangered Species Act. This was initially done in 2008 by the Bush administration, and it was made very clear at that time that this was not a climate change response, simply a reflection of the fact that they fit the endangered species category. Well, a number of environmental NGOs sought to argue before the US federal court that the Endangered Species Act legislative requirement to compile a plan for species protection, here for the polar bear, necessarily required a plan for the reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, which were, of course, causing the deterioration and indeed the elimination of polar bear habitat. Well, that argument failed. Where they did succeed, however, was on the point that the US government should have conducted an environmental impact assessment before listing of the polar bear in 2008, and this was required to be carried out forthwith. In fact, the deadline was yesterday, so I'm not quite sure what's happened there. But the point here is that a principal procedural tool of environmental impact assessment used to assess the state of the polar bear, including, of course, the impact of oil and gas activities in the Arctic upon the habitat. Okay, so those are seven mechanisms. I've only got a few minutes left, and I'd like to do two things. One is just to touch a little bit on the World Heritage Convention, because I referred to it a few times. Then to say just a little bit about geoengineering, and then to have some concluding remarks. Have I got five
You've
more
got
minutes?
Okay, good.
The World Heritage Convention came to the fore in 2005 in the climate change context because of the innovative attempt by NGOs to seek to have inscribed on the list of World Heritage in danger four properties that were identified as particularly imperiled by climate change impacts. I've already mentioned that one was the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. The others were Samarmatha National Park in Nepal, Huascarán National Park in Peru, and the Belize Barrier Reef Reserve System, strange enough, in Belize. And it sought the inclusion of all of those on the list of World Heritage in danger on the basis of climate change impacts. Now, what's interesting about this is two things. One is that at that time, there was no specific mention of climate change as one of the dangerous criteria for inscription on the World Heritage List. The other is that this is not a non-compliance procedure that allows NGOs to complain of state non-compliance under a convention. It's a mechanism where a treaty body is established annually to review the state of world heritage that has been inscribed on the list for protection and recognized as of outstanding universal value for present and future generations. And of course, there's cultural heritage. In this case, it's the natural heritage. And these NGOs simply put this information in what was called a petition, although there was no formal petitioning procedure before the committee, to consider whether it would inscribe. Now, in 2005, it was also not clear whether the committee had independent inscription power. Could it take a property already designated for World Heritage protection, already on the World Heritage List, and put it on the Heritage in Danger List without the consent of the state party in whose territory or offshore waters the heritage site was located? So this petition led to two concrete outcomes within the legal framework of the World Heritage Convention. One was amendments to the operational guidelines, which were finally approved in June of this year, which list, of course, threatening impacts of climatic, geological, or environmental factors as a potential threat to World Heritage property, which would lead to its inscription. And the second, of course, is the possibility for independent inscription without the consent of the state concerned. A long-running dispute under the World Heritage Convention, or I should say controversy, ever since the Jabiluka mine in Kakadu National Park in Australia. So that seems to me a positive outcome. On the negative side, of course, is the fact that there has not been, and indeed I don't think there is likely to be, a property that is only inscribed because of climate change impacts. Inevitably, it will be a range of factors. This is the multiplying effect of climate change. It's one more thing that causes endangerment to World Heritage sites. I think more problematic further is the fact that the World Heritage Convention, like many other environmental treaties, uses the idea of protected areas, of designated areas, for protection of World Heritage sites of natural heritage value in particular. And of course, if it's an ecological site, well, the Great Barrier Reef may not move, but other ecosystems are not going to be static but dynamic. So for a range of environmental instruments, of which the World Heritage Convention is one of our primary tools for environmental protection, protected area status, is now going to come under threat, or at least pressure, because, of course, you might have a migratory species that moves. And even with footprints and pathways, it may be you have to redesignate the areas for protection. But it may be that they move to areas where that protection is impossible to afford. So I see real issues here in national implementation of obligations to establish protected areas and buffer zones if we have this dynamism and volatility, particularly where endangered and where migratory species are concerned, but it's also relevant to the World Heritage context. What we may see, alas, is not just increased danger listing under the World Heritage Convention, but, of course, delisting. That is to say, we can no longer protect this habitat or species in this protected area, and we're not able to afford protection wherever it's migrated to. Now, as you're doubtless aware, there are very few examples of delisting under the World Heritage Convention. One and the first soy example is a direct product of our carbon dependency, which was petroleum licensing activities in Oman, which led to the delisting of a sanctuary for the Arabian oryx because they kept reducing it in size as oil and gas activities or petroleum activities around the park took place to the extent that it was no longer viable in terms of protection of the species. So I don't want to be a doomsayer, but it seems to me that there may unfortunately be more instances of that. Okay. Finally, or penultimately, I just wanted to flag up that in the international environmental law context, I've said that there's addressing impacts, there's addressing the impacts of response mechanisms to climate change. One was CCS, the other was geoengineering. And there is a certain parallelism here because, of course, what we're seeing are attempts to address geoengineering. What is it? Deliberate attempts to manipulate the climate, either to reduce carbon emissions or to enhance solar radiation. How do we do that? One is to increase iron fertilization of the oceans, as I've already referred to. Another is to inject sulfate particulates into the atmosphere to mimic Mount Pinatubo, which will lead to a cloaking, a reflection of sun into space, and of course a cooling of the Earth's atmosphere. Doesn't take CO2 out of the atmosphere, so you've still got acidification of the oceans and so on. And of course, if you don't keep doing it, you'll get a rapid rise in temperature. It is, however, the cheapest and the easiest to accomplish. All you need is a plane and some particulates. So a green doctor knows, someone who wants to go out there and do something for the benefit of the global climate, could do it tomorrow. A rather scary thought. Now, of course, we can regulate aircraft through the registration, the state of registration, or over, of course, overflying territory. You know, there's no right of overflight without consent or subject to a treaty arrangement. But what about common areas? What's to stop an aircraft dispersing sulfate particulates over the middle of the Atlantic Ocean? And this is where I come back to a governance gap, if you will, which is that we have no global instrument on the protection of the atmosphere. Would it address this sort of concern? Well, I'm highly doubtful that it would do so. So whilst identifying the gap, I'm by no means convinced that trying to put into place general environmental principles for atmospheric protection along the lines of oceans environment protection would actually address the intended consequences or unintended consequences of sulfate aerosols. What is clear is that there's an attempt to look around to see what instruments might be deployed to stop geoengineering unless and until we've made proper assessments of the impact on the environment of fertilization in the oceans or sulfate particulates in space. And in the absence of a global convention on the atmosphere, we have the NMOD Convention, which was, of course, adopted in 1977 to prohibit hostile uses of environmental modification. It's a backstop. It's a prohibition on those hostile uses, but it is not a regulatory framework for addressing peaceful uses, geoengineering for climatic responses. So that won't work. Could go through the UN General Assembly, but again, it can't bind states in terms of perhaps a moratorium on sulfate aerosols unless and until some kind of legal framework is in place. So that is an obvious gap in the regulatory framework. Not so for ocean fertilization because of the instruments to which I referred earlier. Clearly, the London Convention and Protocol views ocean iron fertilization as coming within its remit. and the parties to the London Convention have prohibited all activities save for small-scale research in coastal waters for the purposes of assessing on an experimental basis through field trials whether this will actually do the job. The Biodiversity Convention, which is an inherently more politicised convention, has gone a step further. They've looked not just at ocean fertilisation, but geoengineering in the round, and actually considered imposing a blanket prohibition on all geoengineering activities on the basis of the threat to biological diversity, whether terrestrial or marine. In the end, they also stepped back from that and have kept open the possibility of small-scale experimental field trials. But I raise that example because it raises most acutely the point I raised earlier about CITES. The CITES parties have said, well, we're not sure, given that we're dealing with a single threat to species, endangerment through trade, that climate change is for us to address directly. For the CDD, the question arises, how far can they go in addressing geoengineering techniques when the basic object and purpose of the convention is the conservation of biological diversity and the sustainable use of its components? In what way can it seek positively to regulate, to provide a framework for decision-making about if and when states should permit certain geoengineering activities? Where should they take place? What sort of mechanisms and safeguards should be there? We can't do it under the CBD. The Climate Change Convention thus far has not addressed geoengineering except in side events at the COP MOP, partly because there's zero appetite for addressing what is clearly going to be an extremely controversial subject, partly because the first of the two mechanisms I referred to earlier, CCS as well as geoengineering, carbon capture and storage, has been discussed in the climate change context for what seems like decades, I think it's only years now, as to whether it would qualify under the Clean Development Mechanism. We're still not there yet. Some of the concerns are about physical and safety aspects. How can you prevent leakage that might be dangerous to the environment or indeed to human beings? Not to mention the accounting. If you get your certified emission reductions for the storage and then it's leaked, well, you haven't actually stored the CO2 properly then. So it's an accounting issue. But there's also an underlying, I think, ethical and moral issue here as well, which is to say that both CCS and geoengineering, to a large extent, presuppose that it's business as usual, or at least that we can continue with our dependence on the carbon economy. And those that advocate at least scientific experimentation in geoengineering are always very careful to say that it must be mitigate, and that this is just a fallback option that we'll explore in case we need it as option B, if option A, mitigation, doesn't achieve the necessary reductions. But this is an area where, again, you've got a problem and an attempt by states and NGOs to find different fora in which it can be addressed. There isn't a single forum. It is going to be a fragmented response because we already have instruments that can bite off a bit of the cherry, but none that can actually address it in the round. Whether a convention on protection of the atmosphere could do so, I strongly doubt. So, in conclusion, having surveyed, although I only talked in detail at the World Heritage Convention, the main approaches of the key multilateral environmental agreements to climate change impacts and responses, and the impacts on their ability effectively to carry out their main tasks, there's actually little evidence yet of significant changes in the nature of the legal tools and techniques which are deployed under existing international instruments to meet the challenges posed by climate change. Thus far, it's been largely a question of the interpretation and application of existing texts, tools, and techniques, rather than the development of sui generis responses to climate change by these mechanisms, by these instruments. I think in part this reflects the flexible nature of the instruments themselves and of the international lawmaking process. In the case of the major biodiversity treaties, the supplementation of convention texts by COP decisions and operational guidelines, albeit non-binding, but perhaps representing subsequent interpretation by the parties of their treaty obligations, facilitates flexible adaptation over time, supplemented, of course, by overlap in treaty membership and by the institutional cooperation and coordination that I mentioned, and that's to face new challenges, including climate change. That said, I think certain tools and techniques will require modification in the light of climate change impacts. First and foremost is protected areas and their management. Even with the flexibility with the Migratory Species Convention of footprints for birds that set down or corridors for land-based migratory species, there will need to be some adjustment in thinking and more flexibility in national implementation with respect to these measures. I think Thorson's critique of the inevitably limited impact of site-specific mitigation under the World Heritage Convention also makes this point. There's very limited impact that these instruments can have by reducing greenhouse gas emissions in protected areas, for example. So the painful inadequacy of measures to reduce greenhouse gas emissions within Waterton Glacier Park, such as using alternative fuels for the buses, shuttles for staff, and increasing the energy efficiency for park buildings. Well, that's all they can do under their remit. It's a tiny, tiny drip in the pond of what needs to be done. And yet, only 27 glaciers remain, and there's been a 73% decrease in glacial coverage since 1850. The message is that you still need the Climate Change Convention, the climate change regime, to crack on with this essential job of mitigation and reducing greenhouse gas emissions alongside the measures that can be taken in our fixed or flexible protected areas. The second point is there will, alas, I think, be increased use of danger listing, partly for political purposes to highlight climate change impacts and perhaps to mobilise regional and domestic law and procedures. There may, alas, also be increased delisting, where listing is the mechanism used by these instruments. The third is my US Endangered Species Act example underscored, is of course the necessity for environmental impact assessment and also strategic environmental impact assessment. The current discussion of reform of national planning procedures in the UK, which embeds notions of sustainable development, identifies one unsustainable activity with qualifications, which is coal mines. So at the level of legislation, policy and plans, not just particular activities, I think is crucial. The fourth and penultimate is the reference I made earlier to increasing forms of emergency adaptation and ex situ conservation, the rapid response mechanisms that I mentioned. And last but not least, and perhaps the least likely, at least for the moment, is the evolution of compensation or liability regimes to address climate change-related biodiversity loss, environmental impairment, or species extinction. And I say it's the usual reasons for this one. I'm pessimistic. Recognition of liability, forum, standing, and remedies, coupled with the general reluctance to acknowledge historic and future responsibility, and the absence of compensatory justice as an integral part of the climate change regime. So with very few exceptions, climate change actions have been brought almost exclusively before domestic fora, and quite apart from the difficulties of such litigation, the remedies available are inadequate to address the global nature of the problem, as is invariably the case where you have domestic litigation of global issues. And I will stop there. Thank you for your patience. Thank you.